world mythology and ancestral narratives speak of an ET layer to the governance of human society. But are the Sumerian sky people, the Hebrew Elohim, the Egyptian Akhek, the Dogon's Nomos, or the Babylonian Abkalu still present? Are today's close encounters and possible covert treaties with the same powers that our ancestors described from the deep past?
One of the things that might suggest that is the continuity of elites on planet Earth. Elite families that have been at the top of the tree of human society for a very, very long time. When I was a little boy, I was read a story called The Princess and the Pea. The point of the story is that a prince or a king or a queen cannot possibly marry and breed with an ordinary human being. This is anathema. And you listen to the royal stories of any culture around the world, they're very, very careful to maintain the purity of their bloodline so that royals never marry ordinary human beings. And in the past, this has thrown up huge problems because of a narrow gene pool. Around the time of King Henry VIII, some of the kings and queens of Europe looked very, very odd indeed because they were suffering the disadvantages of breeding within the family line. But it was the outcome of a policy that says you have to keep royal bloodlines pure, you can't breed with ordinary human beings. Well, where on earth does that come from? What it really comes from is a desire to keep power in the hands of a very few family.
In 1910, a photograph was taken which included the royal heads of state of nine independent sovereign nations: Norway, Bulgaria, Portugal, Germany and Prussia, Greece, Belgium, Spain, Denmark, and the UK. They are all members of one extended family, everyone related directly or by marriage to one John William Friso.
So you've got nine countries that think they are independent sovereign nations, but they're being run by a single family. How do you make sense of that? I read a book by Jeremy Paxman that talks about the political history of Great Britain. Friends in High Places, it's called. And what Jeremy Paxman demonstrates, and he's a mainstream broadcaster, he was the anchor man for Newsnight for 30-odd years in the UK, and he demonstrates that Great Britain, over 500 years, went through the Reformation, had a revolution, had democratic revolutionary legislation brought in to extend the franchise to everybody, to turn Britain into a democracy, went through two world wars. And yet with all these huge seismic changes, it's still the same five families running Britain who ran it 500 years ago. How is this possible? For me, the persistence hints at the possibility that they are maintaining a power structure that was established thousands of years ago.
For generations, we've been handed a version of history, neat, polished, and safe, especially for the conquerors. And we've been told that our ancestors were unintelligent and worshipped imaginary gods, and that stories of beings from the sky were superstition, and that the extraordinary is simply impossible. But when you start to look more closely, you find that those stories have been shaped, edited, and even suppressed. So often, the wisdom of our ancestors has been ignored or distorted or simply misunderstood. It's been turned into religion or demeaned or deliberately destroyed. Whole canons of cultural knowledge have been deliberately buried, and along with them, a deeper understanding of who we really are. Across the world, ancient traditions tell of teachers from the sky, of expanded human consciousness, and of human potential waiting to be tapped. And that's why we've started Ancient Knowledge Academy, a community for those who sense that the official mainstream story doesn't quite add up. Here we can look at the evidence, share experiences, and do the inner work together that allows new truth to take root. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today.
In February 1954, President Dwight Eisenhower was on vacation in Palm Springs, California. On February the 24th, in the middle of the night, the president left his resort for a visit to a nearby Air Force base. Why? The Associated Press ran a report that the president had suffered a heart attack and died. 2 minutes later, the story was retracted and replaced with an official statement explaining that the nighttime visit to the Air Force base was for some urgent dentistry. However, from that time to this, sources close to President Eisenhower have leaked another explanation. Far from an urgent dental need, the story has been told that the president was meeting with the representatives of extraterrestrial factions, and moreover, that he was negotiating a treaty.
When I first heard it, I was very skeptical because I thought, just on a basis of logic, what power would we possibly have at a negotiating table with a species advanced enough to get here in the first place? An agreement between us and them would be like an agreement between a mouse and a lion that the mouse is going to get eaten. But once you realize that we are talking about multiple ET presences, multiple ET demographics, once you accept that an intergalactic federation is probably quite good language for what's going on, Haymashed is only echoing what the ancients said when they talked about a sky council, such as you find in the Hebrew scriptures. Once you realize there is this multiplicity of demographics at the table, then you realize that there must be treaties and agreements being made, and that our treaty with them is really about how we are positioned among those demographics. They will all be here with slightly different agendas. This is what our ancestors told us. They often conflict with one another over their agendas for Project Humanity and Project Earth.
Was Eisenhower's deal something to do with an exchange of access or of people for technology? Was there an imperative for humanity to curtail its experimentation with nuclear fission?
Even casual observers of the UFO phenomenon would know that our nuclear technology is very relevant to our intersection with our neighbors. There was such a spat of UFO sightings, close encounters, in the wake of the detonations of the bombs that destroyed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out there's a connection. And then you start watching the topic, and you discover that nuclear armaments were activated and deactivated during the Cold War, the nukes of the USA, the nukes of the Soviet Union, by powers that we didn't know who they are. Follow the story to Chernobyl, and there is the public mass sighting reported in the mainstream press of a flying saucer situated near Reactor 4, which did not go into full meltdown somehow. And thank goodness it didn't, because we would have not been able to occupy about a third of Europe had it melted down. It would be a giant Chernobyl zone if that had happened. So there is a connection there. And you know, therefore, if you join the dots, that there are at least one or two demographics on the council very concerned about the planet and very concerned about what we're doing with nukes. There would be demographics saying we need to be more open, to be more empowering to the human race, and others saying no, absolutely not. And they will have different things that would ally themselves with human interests. So the positive take home for me of that is to know we do have some allies at the table, that there are some ET presences here who are pro-human, who in some way, shape, or form are looking out for the interests of the human race. And then there may be others here for whom we're a total inconvenience. They're here for other reasons. They're here for what the planet can offer. And so these treaties are not just between us and them, It's a complex matrix of treaties that keeps these demographics somewhat in check. And non-disclosure has been the basis of those agreements for a long time. When people get frustrated and angry with, say, the US government for being so secretive on contact, it's the most secretive power on Earth, comparing it with other countries. And they get frustrated and, can't we force NASA to tell us what they know? Can't we force the Pentagon to tell us what they know? Well, no, if the policy of non-disclosure is decided here rather than here. And so I think the Eisenhower story is really perhaps the first story we have of exopolitics, of diplomacy, as he had to think through where do we sit on this table for our best interests.
The image of the small grey has become pop culture's shorthand for an extraterrestrial. The image is, in fact, thousands of years old. Some who report close encounters with small greys describe a lack of emotion and suggest that these small visitors may be merely the workforce of an even more advanced species. But who are they, and what are their cosmic origins?
When you listen to people's encounters with them, it does seem that some of the greys operate for others, that they are the worker bees, so to speak, of somebody else. They're sitting in some rather junior part of this federation. And some people who've had encounters with them have found, to their surprise, that they can sometimes get rid of them and take charge of them and not do what they want. That's rather intriguing, but it makes sense if they're somewhat chosen, selected, programmed, engineered to be the ones who are taking orders. But I think the greys are actually a range of entities. I think you've got some that are like that, that a kind of dronish, that there's no sense of any interior life or emotionality to them, is what people report who encounter them. But then there are others who look very similar, yet who have a far more layered and sophisticated way of communicating, where there is some sense of empathy, where there is some imaginative accessing of our own minds and thoughts and feelings as the encounters progress. So I think the greys, that's not just a single demographic. And we shouldn't be surprised to get into the language of engineered species once we realize that our ancestral narratives say we're an engineered species, and that we were carefully engineered to have a very particular level of consciousness. If that's what our ancestors said about us, then it's not too much of a stretch to say, well, there are other species out there who have been engineered by their cosmic cousins, and the greys would be an example of that.
Just how far back do stories of genetic engineering go in the world of ancestral narratives and creation mythologies?
In the beginning, God, Elohim, created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was formless and empty, tohu wa bohu. The deep waters were covered in darkness, and the Spirit of God, the Ruach, was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. Are these verses a poetic account of creation? How, in the 21st century, is this story to be interpreted?
Well, it's not a story about creation, and it's not a story about God. It's the story of the Elohim, the powerful ones who came and terraformed our planet in the deep past. That word Elohim, which often gets translated as God, is a masculine plural form noun. It often takes plural form verbs, plural attributives. It demonstrates plural behaviors. Let us make the humans to look like one of us. and it demonstrates plural agendas. We have the wars of the Elohim in the Hebrew canon, this jealous conflict among the Elohim as they compete with one another for hegemony and resources. So first off, it's not a story of God, if by God we mean the source of the cosmos and everything in it. The Elohim was the Hebrew word for the sky people of the Mesopotamian stories.
The Mesopotamian stories from the ancient cultures of Sumeria, Babylonia, Arcadia, and Assyria speak of the arrival on planet Earth of advanced extraterrestrial people in our deep past. These stories, curated by the world's oldest known culture, with the world's oldest body of written texts, speak of Anunnaki, sky people, who colonized planet Earth, genetically modifying our hominid ancestors and governing over planet Earth for tens and hundreds of thousands of years. These Mesopotamian stories are not religious texts, nor do they speak in any length of an almighty God. They are the stories of plural advanced beings not from Earth and not human. Enki is the commander of Project Earth. His younger brother Enlil is the commander of this region of space. Other entities, Nama, Ninhursag, Kingu, Marduk, all play their part in a story of conflicts over their agendas for our planet and our race. The stories of the Elohim, the powerful ones of the Bible, appear to be a summary form of these even more ancient recollections of sky people.
The moment you put Elohim back into the plural and read these stories as the stories of the powerful ones, you realize what we have is the summary form of the Mesopotamian stories about Enlil and Enki and the sky people.
So are the early narratives of Genesis creation stories, only giving the credit for that work of creation to a different kind of entity? Or is something else being recalled?
The reason I'm so confident this is not a creation story as we imagine it to be is that before any word of creation is spoken, before the let there be light and the advent of the sun and the moon and the stars, planet Earth already exists, and it's flooded and shrouded in darkness. Now, some would say you're over-interpreting the order of the sentences, that we've been told that in the beginning the Earth was in a chaotic state, and now we're going to be told how we got there. The reason I don't think that is the right reading is that almost every ancestral narrative concerning the origins of our civilization begin with a planet that is flooded and shrouded in darkness. We find it here in Genesis. I am saying this is a restatement of the Mesopotamian stories, which begin with the descent of the sky people to the flood waters, which then have to be separated using vortices of wind. You go to the Philippines and you've got stories of the Tagalog, the hawk, hovering over the flood waters, using its wings to create vortices to begin clearing land so that the planet can be terraformed. You listen to the Edo people of Nigeria, and they talk about Osanabua, the Almighty One above the waters, who arrives and begins terraforming. You listen to the story of the arrival of Viracocha over the waters of Lake Titicaca. It's the same thing. Now here in Genesis, we have the arrival of the Ruach. And again, the root meaning of that word implies something that creates a wind. And that is the story of terraforming we find all around the planet. So that's why I'm confident that the order of sentences in Genesis is quite correct. Our memories do begin on a planet that is flooded and chaotic. And the phrase in the Hebrew, tohu wa bohu, implies the planet has been devastated by a cataclysm. And that is when the powerful ones show up.
The Ruach, the so-called Spirit of God. Ruach is a term that is always translated as a spirit, because theology always tends to give a spiritual reading to all biblical tales. But we will see that this is not the case. The Ruach first appears at the very beginning of the Old Testament, where, in verse 2 of the first chapter of Genesis, it is narrated that the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. Actually, the Bible says that the Ruach of the Elohim, remember it is the plural term, was merachefet, over the surface of the water. Merachefet is the verb rachaf, expressed in the past participle, and it indicates precisely a particular type of flight. For example, it means the kind of flight typical of hunting birds when they spread their wings and, holding them almost still, they let themselves be carried by the wind. The verb rachaf is used in the Old Testament in Jeremiah and Deuteronomy, where it indicates trembling and the soaring of an eagle over its nest. So, the situation that is described in Genesis becomes very clear and concrete. The Elohim hovered over the waters using this medium that is called Ruach. Ruach means wind, the air that moves, or even something that moves in the air. Successively, its meaning evolved over time until it became spirit. This is the term that theologians and exegetes of various religions have always been using to translate Ruach. However, we will see that this choice is not necessarily correct. First, let us talk about the so-called visions of Ezekiel. The term visions is a translation of the Hebrew word mare, but even there, the interpretation given does not take into account the concreteness of the Hebrew language. The Hebrew term mare, on the other hand, indicates the concrete act of seeing something real. More precisely, we can even say that it indicates precisely that which is observed, an object, a person, a situation, a scene, an event, a phenomenon, and thus naturally also the concept of physical appearance. In essence, it refers to something that is actually seen with one's own eyes. Let's never forget that ancient Hebrew is a very, very concrete language.
Now, in the previous episode Maro and I did on the word kavod, which gets translated as glory, we discovered that kavod was a piece of technology that has seats in it, that can be piloted and flown around. It makes a particular sound. It arrives in a particular way, very disruptive to the environment around it. It has textures like metal, textures like glass, and it creates great blasts of air when it moves. There's that ruach concept, the movement of air. Ezekiel describes that craft using two words interchangeably, kavod and ruach. So once again, we have a text where a ruach cannot be interpreted as breath or spirit, because in Ezekiel, the ruach is made of metal, is made of a glass-like substance, has a pilot to pilot it, has seats in it that can take passengers, which include Ezekiel, can be flown and directed, the wings respond to voice commands, and it has wheels. the omnidirectional wheel, which, if you remember, NASA has a patent on, actually uses, patent established in 1974 by Josef Blumreich. So clearly, the Spirit of God doesn't have wheels. NASA doesn't have a patent on the Spirit of God. This usage of the word Ruach is a reference to ancient technology. Now, it's worth noting that when Ezekiel uses these words, Kavod and Ruach, to describe this craft that arrives from the sky out of a whirlwind wind, and we'll come back to that in a moment, that he can climb into and be flown in. He uses these words, Kavod and Ruach, in a way that he expects his readers to understand. He expects Ruach and Kavod to conjure up in the minds of his readers a craft. And so that tells us that there was a body of knowledge widely held about ancient spacefaring technology, knowledge which has since been lost. And I argue in my Eden books that the knowledge was lost through mistranslation, some accidental and some possibly deliberate, as the stories of paleo contact were obscured in the Bible in the 6th century BCE, when the redactors worked over the great library of Hebrew texts to turn the Bible into a seamless story of God from beginning to end.
Unlock transformative courses, experience live mentoring sessions, and connect with our global community of seekers. Go to ancientknowledgeacademy.com to begin your journey today.